Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Missouri State Representative Rory Ellinger of University City passed away earlier today, losing his battle with cancer. We'll remember him and his accomplishments a little bit later in the program. But first, child abuse and neglect is a problem that does not seem to go away. In fact, it's getting worse. Thousands of cases are reported in the St. Louis region every year. Dozens of youngsters die nationally as a result of the abuse or neglect. The fallout is considerable in other ways. Nationally, it's an $80 billion problem. That's the cost of dealing with abuse and includes what is spent on child welfare, hospitalization, and to move cases through the justice system. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and with me to talk about the problem locally and efforts to deal with it, Brenda Malley is Chief Executive Officer for Children's Permanency Partnership, an organization that provides services to help children and their families achieve stable, healthy futures. Pam Ousset is Chief Program Officer with the Family Resource Center. The center's mission is to help prevent and treat child abuse and to help strengthen families. Dawn Swinger is a family therapist with the Family Resource Center. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pam Ousset, I'll begin with you. Kind of give us a picture, if you will, of what's going on locally with regard to child abuse.
Well, I think that we all know about, we've seen the terrible news reports about children being abused and children actually even losing their lives as a result of abuse. And it's a big, big problem. But what we don't know is what's really the underlying, you know, is there more to it? Is it being underreported? And of course, like most crimes, of course, it's absolutely underreported. Some of the statistics that we know just here in our greater St. Louis area, that in 2012, there was over 13,000 reports of abuse and neglect regarding children. And that involved actually 19,000 children just in our area. So some of those were brothers and sisters. Of those, about 900 of them were actually substantiated. Seven of those were deaths due to child abuse and neglect here just in our area. And around the state, there was about 34 deaths that year. And most of those, I think about 31 of them, were under the age of 6 years old. So they were actually under the age of five. I'm sorry. They were 4 years old or younger.
Why this disparity between the number of cases reported and those that are substantiated? I mean, the difference is quite stark.
It is quite stark. And I think that sometimes what happens in the home stays in the home. I think that's one reason. We don't always know. We're not always aware. Sometimes we might be, you know, walking, shopping at Schnucks. We might see a child being yanked out of the arm or a child being screamed at or pushed down, whatever. And most of us maybe are a little bit fearful of knowing what to do. Should I call somebody? Should I step in? I'm a little bit afraid to do that. So it's not always recognized. It's not always easy to spot. The big thing that we need to remember, all of us, is that we err on the side of caution. If we have a reasonable suspicion that a child may be harmed, then we should go ahead and call. We should call the hotline number. Let them investigate that.
We'll give that number later in the program, obviously, and we'll have it on our website. Pam, you wanted to say something?
I was going to add to what Pam had to say, in that sometimes child abuse is reported, but it's unable to be substantiated. You know, there's not the correct kind of proof. Sometimes stories conflict, and maybe in some of those cases the abuse did occur, but it was not able to be substantiated. In some cases, the state's children's division will come in and offer more help because they think maybe the abuse occurred. Other times they say, well, there's just no evidence that it occurred.
Brenda, I think part of the situation here and the uncertainty and lack of clarity is the definition of child abuse. What is its definition?
Well, there's several aspects to it. You can have actually the physical abuse, which is what I think most people think of, and most children are physically abused. And then second would be emotional abuse and also neglect, which, you know, not meeting the needs of your kids, I think, is number two, the second biggest part of child abuse and neglect. Then you can have a smaller number of kids sexually abused or emotional abuse, you know, screaming at kids, you've heard the stories of people who tell their kids, you know, well, you're not worth anything and you'll never amount to anything. And those, that's really emotional abuse if you speak to your children that way.
Mm-hmm. Is there a profile of both the abused and the abuser, Brenda?
No, there's not. For the abusers, it can be your next door neighbor who you think is a real stand-up person. And abused children, there isn't really a race or age or sex. There's really nothing that defines a specific group of kids. Most of the children are 51% of the abused kids are six and under. So it's a larger percentage are the younger kids.
Pam, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, Brenda's right. You know, this can happen anywhere, and it does happen anywhere, in all kinds of families and all socioeconomic spheres. But what we do know is that what we have found through some research, there are some risk factors in family where there's abuse after abuse, what we call chronic maltreating families. And so does that cause abuse? No. But it's we want to look for those risk factors. So some of those, for instance, we find domestic violence. We find substance abuse. We find single heads of household, moms, where they're the head of the household. Oftentimes, parent grew up in child in foster care themselves, and a lot of times they will have children under the age of five, multiple children. So younger children, sometimes younger parents, they've been through the foster care system, and other things going around, other chaos in their lives.
I guess this is where you come in, Dawn, in terms of dealing with a youngster who has experienced this sort of thing and this chaos as just described.
Absolutely. We get referrals from lots of different sources, sometimes the parents themselves who are seeking help for a child who they know has suffered some sort of abuse, and they bring them in for treatment. And we have lots of different models that include the parent in part of that healing process for the child.
You know, I think it's well known and widely reported that youngsters who are abused very often wind up being abusers themselves later in life. What is going on here? Do we know why?
Well, we know that the number is a third, approximately a third of the people who abuse their kids were abused themselves. And I think it's they grew up that way, and they never had any intervention. Nobody came in and said, this isn't the way to do it. This isn't how you parent your kids. The people who were abused and I think get out of it are people who get services, people who have interventions from some of the social services agencies around town. I think Pam probably wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think that the thought of, is this generational? Does it happen from one generation to the next? And I think we do see that. And I think it's real easy for us to think about, oh, those child-abusing people, they're horrible, horrible people, and the poor children. Of course, that's how we think. That's how all of us feel. But we also have to realize that today's abusing parent was 25 years ago, they were the children that we had such empathy for who didn't get help. And so there's help out there. Places, there's lots of agencies like ours, Family Resource Center, have lots of services. But most parents don't want to hurt their children. Most parents care deeply for their children. But they have never seen what a good parent looks like. And they're guessing at it often. And they're doing the best that they can and what they were taught.
They think this is the way to parent because
Absolutely.
That's the way their parents treated them.
That's right.
What form does the help that's out there take?
There's lots of different types of help, some in the form of prevention and some in the form of treatment when the abuse has already occurred. Some really strong prevention programs that are out there. There's a state program called Intensive In-Home Services. It's a wonderful program where a child is actually at imminent risk of being removed from the home because something has happened and it's deemed not to be safe for the child to stay there. So it's very intensive services, crisis kind of intervention work where somebody's on call, a social worker, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 6 weeks to try to create a safe environment for that child. Lots of programs. We invented one at Family Resource Center thinking like, what could we come up with to try to prevent child abuse? We call it Path Builders. And it's really looking at a combination of building in concrete supports for parents because a lot of them don't have adequate housing. They don't have jobs or job skills. They lack childcare and transportation. It's a multitude of issues. and at the same time provide them with parenting classes and often therapy, because a lot of our parents have been experienced trauma in their own lives.
It seems to me that this is a little like locking the barn door after the horse is gone, because the timing for when you can move in or where you can offer your help is often after the abuse has occurred.
Sometimes. There are various programs. For instance, we have a therapeutic preschool. We're one of such three in the state, where we get to kids when they're 3, 4, and 5 years old. I think that's one of the best prevention programs we have at Family Resource Center. And so a lot of these kids are already in foster care. They've already in their young lives experienced things that I have never experienced. But it's very, again, intensive. They have a therapy. We work with the family if they're in the foster home, or the foster home, try to help them to get to their biological home back there if that's safe. And we have a whole program of services to try to help them have a successful start into kindergarten and really have a second chance at a better life just in general.
Dawn, does denial come into the equation here when you're talking about working with the parents, denying that, in fact, there is an issue?
Certainly that happens. I think when it's risen to the level that the children are already in foster care, parents often have to work through that denial about what they did was harmful to their child and that they caused their child to be removed from the home. That's a difficult process for the parent often, but, you know, with a lot of empathy and support, many parents do get past that and learn how to be a better parent.
Mm-hmm. Does the economic times play into it? Brenda, I'm wondering if when unemployment comes into the picture or resources are more limited than they might have been otherwise, is that part of the picture?
Well, that's an age-old question. Uh-huh. And statistically, child abuse has risen. The trend is numbers are increasing really almost every year, sometimes not by a lot, but the numbers are not going down. So you can perhaps draw a conclusion, but I don't think that there's any hard evidence that there's a relationship. We do know that kids are at risk perhaps more in families that have socioeconomic pressures upon them.
Yeah,
go ahead, Ben.
I would agree with that. I think and again, we want to be careful not to say that stress or unemployment or inadequate housing causes child abuse. That's not what we want to say. That's not what research shows. But it certainly poses an added risk factor and maybe more of a propensity for parents who don't have skills to learn how to cope that they go that extra step and go over the edge.
Yeah. I have to take a break now. We'll do that now. We're talking about child abuse. It seems to be a growing problem, and it certainly is an issue here in our area where we're talking about thousands of reported cases every year. A number of youngsters die as a result of child abuse. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. My guests in studio are Brenda Malley, Chief Executive Officer for Children's Permanency Partnership. Dawn Swinger is a family therapist with the Family Resource Center. Pam Mousset is the Chief Program Officer with the Family Resource Center. We'll come back and continue this conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, we'll take that too at STL On Air. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Our subject today is child abuse. We'll continue that conversation with Brenda Malley, Dawn Swinger, and Pam Mousset in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri State Representative Rory Ellinger has died at the age of 72. The Democrat from University City had been battling an aggressive form of liver cancer. He is being remembered by his colleagues for his willingness to work across the aisle. Toward the end of this program, we'll talk with our reporter Marshall Griffin about Ellinger's career in the legislature. The Republican-led Missouri House is expected to vote today on legislation barring labor agreements in which union fees are required of all employees at a business. And mothers of children who have been killed or injured by guns are sharing their stories today at University of Missouri-St. Louis Conference on Reducing Urban Violence. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our guests, Brenda Malley, Dawn Swinger, and Pam Mousset. What are the signs of abuse? What should we be looking for out on the street or on the bus or on the Metrolink or wherever? And I would add that I think you probably have to be pretty careful here in doing this. Brenda, go ahead.
Right. There are some specific things that people can look for, and that would be frequent injuries or unexplained bruises or welts, cuts on children. If children are always on alert, they're very watchful, they're hesitant to interact with you. If they shy away from any kind of touch, if their clothing is inappropriate or they don't have a winter coat, you can watch for the way the children behave will be a good indicator.
Of course, the most visible sign would be signs of injury, but mm-hmm. kids are kids and they get bumps and bruises all the time, which is complicates things.
Could be a pattern. You know, the kids always seem to have bruises. Teachers are really good identifiers of this. The kids who come to school every day and they've got a new or a different bruise. And sometimes when they're asked, the kids will have very unusual stories that don't make sense to the adult.
Pam, are teachers the first line of defense here?
They're certainly one of them. There's a lot of folks out there in professions that are what we call mandated reporters, you know, social workers, therapists, nurses, doctors, teachers, principals, police officers. So there's a lot of folks out there who, if, and again, stressing that we don't have to be assured that abuse has occurred, but if there's a reasonable suspicion, then we have to call the hotline.
Yeah. Don, I'll come to you on this. It may not be in your wheelhouse, as they say. With regard to law enforcement, how well trained are law enforcement officers to recognize and deal with these situations?
I do know that they receive training on a regular basis around identifying child abuse and neglect, and they actually have special departments.
Crisis intervention teams mm-hmm. are now being developed, and police are really getting much better training than they have in the past to identify and take action on child abuse. And there are specific officers that are trained and called in cases of child abuse. Mm.
Getting back to the idea of reporting it, it seems to me, Pam, that we're on a slippery slope here. I mean, this is a litigious society, and if you make a mistake and report somebody and it doesn't turn out to be a case of abuse, you've got a problem.
You don't really – well, you're not going to get sued. What the problem is, really, is if you suspect abuse and we don't report it. If we have to look at this from the eyes of a child, you know, children are small. They don't have much power. They don't really even have a voice. And they depend upon adults, every single one of us, to be their voice and to be their champion. And if we don't take that seriously – we're just perpetuating the problem. So sometimes it doesn't feel comfortable to call, but you have to. Everybody has to weigh that individually. But keep in mind, err on the side of caution for that child.
Which apparently is what a lot of people do. If you've got 19,000 calls and you only substantiate 800 or so cases, most of the calls are in error somehow.
Correct. And I wanted to add that when you call the hotline, those calls are anonymous. So you would give your name and your identifying information. But for instance, children that come into care, it's against the law to disclose who made the report for that brought that child into care. So we can't tell the parent that it was their next door neighbor that made this call about you. So there's a number of ways that callers can be protected.
Have there been situations in which the youngsters are calling if they're angry at their parents and make charges? I've heard that sort of thing happens. I've even heard that children sometimes threaten their parents with making such a call.
I think it does happen.
Yeah.
You know, children sometimes do that. And sometimes it is because they're angry at their parents. But I think there are also cases where there actually is something not going on the way it should be at home. And it might be somewhat of a cry for help. They may even take back later that they had called for help that was legitimate.
Pam, any insight into that?
part of the story? I think that's a good analysis of what happens. Kids sometimes get angry. They call. And just some of them are certainly bogus. You know, they're mad at their parents, but other times maybe not.
It's not an infrequent thing for kids in foster care to do, especially the kids that have been in foster care for a number of years. They know the system and they get mad at their foster parent and they know, well, you know, I'll just make a call and get them in trouble, because they're really pretty adept at managing in the system.
Is it too much of a stretch to say that most of the kids in foster care are probably kids who have been abused?
Yeah, there's been substantiated abuse on all children in foster care, whether it be neglect, physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. There has been substantiated abuse on all of the children.
Dawn, what a burden that puts on the foster parents in terms of having to deal with the psychological fallout, if nothing else, in this situation.
Yes, it does. And they, too, receive training to help them to cope with that. And certainly, if that child comes into therapy, they're welcome to be part of that therapeutic process to help them deal with the abuse.
I'm just going to say I applaud foster parents, because it's not an easy thing to do, and it takes somebody special and somebody with a great heart to be able to do that and take on sometimes some pretty significant challenges that foster children come with.
We have a number of calls, not really surprisingly. Let's get to them now. I have other questions, of course, but I'd like to get these questions from listeners. Jason in St. Charles, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Don, I wanted to amplify your point a little bit earlier about some of these interventions, although being extremely valuable, are often too little too late. I'm a pediatrician, and the abuse victims that I work with the most are infants that have been the victim of critical abusive head trauma. What strikes me is that for young parents, oftentimes they're asked or given the opportunity to go through birthing classes and that sort of thing, but there's nobody around to tell them what the experience of having a colicky two-month-old at home is like. There's nobody around to tell them about respite resources like the St. Charles Crisis Nursery or the St. Louis Crisis Nursery. And so they're put into a situation where they have limited family resources. There might be a problem with addiction. Maybe one of the partners is unemployed, or it may not even be biologically related to the child. And everybody's sleep deprived, and the child doesn't stop crying, and a tragedy occurs. They're not monsters, but we put them in a situation where the family is vulnerable and persistently in crisis. And like one of the guests said, it's just a chaotic situation, and we expect them to respond perfectly appropriately at all times, and then brand them as monsters when they don't. It doesn't excuse the problem, but it certainly goes a long way to explaining it. And I would advocate that if we're serious about reducing the burden of child abuse, then what needs to happen is aggressive, sustained campaigns at respite childcare, at parenting classes, and giving people the resources, high quality, early child care, longer family, parent leave at the birth of a child so that everybody can get involved early on and bond with the child. If we're really serious about reducing the burden of child abuse, then these are some of the things that we need to do, but they're expensive, and I haven't been impressed that the will is there.
Thank you very much for the call. Brenda, do you want to respond to that call?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. There are programs that are parent young people having children. There are therapy programs, but the problem is, as Jason said, there's no way for most of the people to know about it. So we haven't done as good a job as we should in educating the public, but it's getting the press time to say these programs are out there, and then getting neighbors and friends to say, hey, I know about a program that you can go to. So we really have to educate the society about what programs are out there.
Certainly must be the case, because the situation gets worse year after year.
I think a lot of abusive parents, too, what we know is that they're socially isolated. So they're, just as your caller said, you know, parents are out there struggling. A lot of the parents who end up being abusive, they don't have anybody to call upon. They don't have friends. They don't have family members who would be appropriate and they can count on to really help them out. And that too has to change. We have to find ways to connect people together individuals, every single one of your listeners, can look at their own lives. And if they see somebody struggling, maybe it's a family member of theirs that needs help, offer to help. It could be immensely useful and helpful for them.
And dealing with therapy, Dawn, with children and parents, how long does it take to really make a change, or can you make a change, really?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, a lot of what we see by the time it comes to the therapist is complex trauma,
right,
meaning that they've suffered lots of different traumas and the family is in real trouble. Those kind of cases, some therapists work with families for years. And, you know, they see progress along the way, but it's not something that's easily, you know, solved.
What sort of punishment is out there for parents who abuse?
Well, if they're convicted of a crime, they go to jail.
Well, isn't abuse a crime?
And not in all cases. In a lot of the cases, every case of substantiated child abuse goes before the court. And the court then, the judge has the option. He looks at all of the factors. And the real goal is to keep the family together. So the judges are very aware of the programs and what help is out there for the family. And so the judge will say, okay, well, these are the things you have to do to get your children back. And then it's the parent works with the system, basically, the social services system, to go through those processes to get their kids back. In the cases of serious, you know, they've broken legs or head trauma or sexual abuse, those people end up in jail.
But basically, the first step is to try to work together with the family and using therapy and to keep them all together.
The different intervention programs.
We want to help, not punish. You know, if you think about that, like I said, a lot of the parents have been abused as children themselves. So if we can teach them and show them there's a different way, there's hope for change.
Right. A number of calls, as I indicated earlier. Let's get back to the phones. We'll bring in Sandy calling from Bridgeton. Go ahead, Sandy.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
A couple years ago, one of my children's teachers recorded us for child abuse because my daughter uses an inhaler that causes excessive bruising, and she had on shorts, and she had on all these bruises on her legs. And it was, I mean, I understand why the teacher did it, but let me tell you, the devastating effects it had on innocent people, that was 3 years ago. And my kids are still scared to death that one day somebody's going to come and take them away. And there's just got to be a better way in order to catch the kids who need it. Let's not scare kids who don't need it.
Thanks for the call. It's an interesting slant on this situation. Who would like to respond? Dawn?
I just wanted to say, you know, Sandy, I'm really sorry that you went through this and your children went through this. Unfortunately, mistakes do happen. I think Brenda, you know, spoke to that earlier, and we hope that they don't happen very often because it can be devastating to children and families.
We have an email here from Jean. I'll synopsize what Jean has said. She says she thinks the state has gone way too far in their efforts to prevent child abuse and neglect. She points to a situation in which a parent, a loving, caring parent, might leave a child in the car seat for a minute or two running into a store to get something and come on back out, and they could be accused of neglect, even abuse. Has the state gone too far, Brenda?
My opinion is not. I think that if, you know, 20 years ago people left their kids in cars and they ran into the store and thought they were safe, and we know today that's just not the case. You leave kids in hot cars and they die. You leave kids in cars unattended and people take the cars, and the risks are just too great right now. It's just the society we live in.
I would agree.
Ben.
It's a terrible thing, but I would agree.
Yeah. Let's take another call from Effingham, Illinois. Dave joins us. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I think earlier in the show you quoted a statistic of 13,000 reported cases and 900 substantiated cases, and I think my question goes back to a couple of callers ago. What happens to the 12,100 people who are affected in huge ways by these, and what kind of tracks are left on their reputations, and how does that play out?
Thanks for the call, Dave. Who'd like to take that?
Well, Brenda. if the parent has been accused of child abuse, it is on their record they've been accused of child abuse. But then there will be court documents that will say it was unsubstantiated. There will be documentation to say that this didn't happen. And unfortunately, that's one of the pieces of the fallout of the whole system. But I don't think anybody knows of a better way to do it right now.
And the other thing is, with some of these calls, is 13,000, though they weren't all substantiated, there will be a number of those cases where there was deemed to be some sort of risk factor, and the state or the children's division made a determination that some kind of services would be helpful for that family. Mm-hmm. And so they try to implement that, some kind of services help. And it might be therapy, it might be parenting classes. So they were deeming that something's going on, they need some help.
Right. I have to take another break. We'll do that now. You just heard from Pam Musette, Chief Program Officer with the Family Resource Center. Also with me in studio, Dawn Swinger, Family Therapist with the Family Resource Center, and Brenda Malley is Chief Executive Officer for Children's Permanency Partnership. Back to take more of your calls in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion on child abuse. I'm going to go right to the phones. Jim will join us from St. Louis. Jim, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Don. I'm involved in an organization called Angels Arms, and some of the panelists may be aware of this nonprofit. We provide 10 homes to foster children across the St. Louis area. A lot of the children in these homes have suffered horrific abuse. And yet it seems that the Missouri's stated goal is always reunification with the birth parents. Oftentimes, I and others question whether this stated goal is the right thing for the child in many instances. And I'd just like the panelists' opinions on at what point in the process or when these children are going through the system should we advocate for complete separation from the birth parents for the protection of the child.
That's totally mandated by the law. The federal statutes require that parental reunification be the number one goal in every case when a child comes into foster care. The family has a specific period of time in which they can accomplish the assignments that the court has put upon them so that they can get their kids back. In some cases, I realize that there is such frustration that the kids have been so abused, and it's hard to think about sending those kids back into those homes. And I think that a family that is fostering a child can advocate at any time for what they think is best for the child in their home.
We have a call from Ronald in O'Fallon, Illinois. He's on the same track. Ronald, did that answer your question?
It kind of did. Thank you for taking my call. I guess to just expand on it, being someone that is a foster to a child like that, the question is, well, like you said, we can always advocate, but it seems like it's in vain. You talk to different caseworkers, court case dates are always expanded or, thrown on the back burner due to criminal court cases. And it seems like the child is always left, to fend until after everything is said and done. And then it's kind of too late. You've grown attached to the child or, you just don't know what to do. You get so frustrated because you want to show the child love and everything. But there is no one to necessarily help you in the situation of advocating for the child due to what the state deems right of sending the child back home or, fighting for the parents who in turn abuse the child or put the child in that situation.
Dawn, it would occur to me that maybe this is an area for you. I mean, the foster parents might be in need of some therapy as well.
Yes, I think that is true. You actually brought up several points that are absolutely true. You know, foster parents become attached to these children. The children become attached to them. Sometimes it doesn't look like it's possible for the children to return to their parents. Hopefully, as a foster parent, you will be able to reach out to get the help you need. And sometimes that's a therapist for you. And sometimes it's just also working along with the child's therapist. Most children are assigned to a therapist.
I think foster parents really do have power in terms of pushing things through the court system. Our judicial system has some real problems in dealing with this whole issue, and I think that foster parents do have more power than they think that they have.
Okay. Now let's take the other side of the coin, I believe, is what we're going to get from Jay calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. And I'll tell you, I've listened to this conversation, and I'm actually a product of the foster care system. And, you know, I can legitimately say that, you know, I think there's a lot of good discussion about, you know, how great the foster care system is. And there are some good things, but, you know, I can tell you I did not have a good experience at all in the foster care system. And because of opportunities outside of the, you know, foster care system, whether it be churches or different organizations or different things with the school, I feel like great strides were made. You know, I'm a college graduate now. I own several businesses. I have a family of my own. And again, I'm not saying that foster care is bad, but I think there are there should be some emphasis where organizations that are not necessarily, you know, state funded or foster care, you know, based, they have the ability to make a huge difference in these kids' lives. And I think that's one of those things that we should talk a little bit more about, because that, you know, I didn't have a great experience at all. And I know a lot of us didn't, but other resources and other programs and churches and things like that should step up a little bit to make a better impact with the kids out there. So,
thank you so much for your call, Dawn. I noticed that you've been nodding affirmatively throughout.
Right. What makes me think of, and I hope it's not too overused, but it takes a village to raise kids, and that includes kids in foster care. So I really like your comment about involving churches and other organizations. And I think there's definitely a move towards collaborating with other agencies to help meet the needs of all children who have been abused, and especially those that end up in foster care.
And I would agree with that. I that's something that at our agency at Family Resource Center, we've been looking at a lot, the entire aspect of collaborating with other agencies. And I would like to stress that funders really fund those opportunities for agencies to be able to do that. We're so used to working in silos and doing our own thing and our own expertise that we're good at. But to really be the most effective, we have to join forces together.
Where does the funding come from for your organization and others?
It's a variety of places. It's United Way. It's the St. Louis County Children's Services Fund. It's the St. Louis Mental Health Board. It's state contracts. It's contracts with the school. So there's – and it's fundraising, tons of fundraising. Without it, we'd be in deep trouble. And I know that that's true for all agencies. So it's a ongoing effort. It's an uphill battle to always keep funding in order to maintain services.
But, Brenda, there is some government funding out there for organizations like yours?
Right. For my organization specifically, because we do foster care case management, I have three organizations, Epworth, Youth in Need, and Family Resource Center. And those three organizations, their foster care programs are fully funded by the state. No, that's really not true. Not fully funded, because the organizations always end up spending more each year than what the state gives them. But the difference is made up, as Pam said, through the fundraising. But predominantly, the funds for foster care comes through the state.
Okay, I have an email here from Brenda, who's happy that we're discussing this today, calling it a huge issue, which it is. And she says, it's one that most people want to pretend doesn't exist. How can I help? Where could I get information on becoming a foster parent or volunteering? And I'm sure that that's the kind of response to a program like this that you all want to hear. Brenda?
Absolutely. We license foster parents. That's part of what we do. And call the family resource phone number, 534-9350, 314-534-9350, and ask for the licensing unit, and they'll begin the process with you, walk you through what it takes to be a foster parent, and put you in the classes and get you started down the road.
We'll put the numbers, by the way, on our website to help out. Go ahead, Pam.
I was going to say there's a number of agencies in the community that I'm sure would love volunteers and to be able to help. And I'm going to give a website at www.stlfamilycommunity.org. And I think that's a list of agencies that can use help. And by help, we mean mentoring. Think about being a mentor. Absolutely. Think about being a volunteer. Think about being a foster parent. Go to fundraising events that organizations put on, and please give a donation if you're able to do that.
All of these information, the websites and phone numbers, will be on our website, by the
way.
Anything to add before I continue? Don?
Go ahead.
Okay. Let's take another call. Lynn will join us. Go ahead, Lynn.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just got a couple things I'd like to say, and then I'll be quiet, and I'll stay on the line if there's a question, and if not, I'll hang up afterwards. One thing that I heard you say is about, you know, teachers, especially teachers, trying to see bruising and stuff like that, what I wanted to say about that is... parents that are really good about this, and I say that from experience, they tend to hit you where bruising won't be evident. And then secondly, I know for me, I was threatened constantly by my father. If you ever tell what goes on here, you'll regret it. And so that's another thing that keeps kids, and that's part of what I don't understand about not wanting to separate the kids from the family when abuse, and it can't be just broken legs and head trauma and stuff. The psychological damage, the constant, I used to have to hang onto a chain while my dad beat me, and it never left marks on my backside, but, you know, he never would have left bruises and stuff where the public would see, because he was always seen as the really great guy in the community. But we lived with the constant threat. What goes on in this family stays in this family. And my mother was a great mother, but I found out later, it took me until I was in college to hear the battered wife syndrome for it to make sense to me why my mother didn't intervene.
Lynn, pardon me for interrupting, but our time is a factor here. Let me come back to our panelists and get their response. I'm guessing that what you're hearing here is nothing new to any of you.
No, not at all. We do know that schools, especially elementary schools and middle schools, are making an effort to talk to kids about it so that kids have a little more freedom to feel like they have the opportunity to talk about it. But it is a huge problem.
And just the fact about the domestic violence, where there's one, you always want to look for the other. If there's domestic violence, you look at child abuse, mm-hmm. vice versa. Very strong link. And I'm so sorry that you went through that, the caller. That I can't imagine what that must have been like. And unfortunately, that happens too often.
Yeah, we just hate to hear stories like that, obviously. We'll take another call here. This one will be from Carl in St. Louis. Carl, go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks very much for... bringing forward the subject matter you are right now, and I'm just lucky that I got a chance to listen on my way to lunch. As a father of five, a question that I have, having left the hospital multiple times with our kids, looking at my wife saying, how do they let us out of this place without a user manual, without some instruction? The question to you panelists is there a way to put in the hands of these new parents, or even before they go home, the kind of information that would let them become more in tune with some of the baggage they're carrying and some of the predispositions that are negative that they might have, so that they could avoid some of these horrible things?
Are you talking about foster parents? I mean foster children?
I'm talking about the parents themselves.
Biological parents?
If the parents leave the hospital before, if we want to get in front of the whole cycle, perhaps we could get these parents in tune with where some of their problems are causing foster children.
Well, I think that you have a really good point. To adopt a child, you have to go to classes and you have to learn a lot about being a parent. But to be a biological parent, there are no requirements. There are no nobody says you have to go to class to learn this, and it's not a bad thing to investigate.
And I don't know in the hospital after giving birth, I don't know how much of like an assessment that the hospital does in terms of a parental background, in terms of their needs. There might be some of that, but that's actually a good idea. Maybe that would be something that would be helpful for anyone.
Yeah. We're reaching the end of our time, and I just want to alert folks to the fact that your child abuse prevention kickoff, prevention month kickoff, is happening Friday, April 11th at 10:30 at the Jones Education and Visitor Center in Forest Park. In 30 seconds, can someone tell me, Brenda, what's going to be happening there?
The media will be there. There'll be representatives and congressmen. We have a speaker who's going to talk about what it was like to grow up as an abused child, and it's giving the community an opportunity to come and learn about child abuse and learn about options and learn about the organizations out there that can help.
Obviously, much interest in the subject matter is indicated by the number of phone calls we received today. That's happening Friday, April 11th, 10:30 at Forest Park at the Visitor Center. I want to thank you, Brenda Malley, Dawn Swinger, and Pam Musette for being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about an upcoming international conference in St. Louis about the role in many forms of public art and sculptures. The Gateway Arch is perhaps the most recognizable here in St. Louis, but there is so much more. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.